Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
You're listening to Heritage Radio Network. Since 2009, HRN podcasts have been exploring the wide world of food, beverage, and agriculture. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org. This is What Doesn't Kill You, Food Industry Insights. I'm your host, Katie Kiefer, and I'm really pleased to have on my show today, Keith Schneider. Keith Schneider edits and reports on the intersection of energy, food, water, and resources from across the United States and around the world. He is a former national correspondent and remains a regular contributor to the New York Times. He also reports for The Guardian, ProPublica, National Geographic, Energy News Network, Manga Bay Times, The New Lead, and Circle of Blue. Circle of Blue's Choke Point Project, which includes a group of reports by Keith and focused on Australia, India, Mexico, Mongolia, Panama, Peru, Qatar, did I say that right? South Africa and the United States won the Rockefeller Foundation's $100,000 Centennial Innovation Award. Bravo. Keith's other major prizes include two George Polk Awards for Environmental and National Reporting, and the New York Times nominated him for a Pulitzer Prize in National Reporting for uncovering the deteriorated condition of the U.S. nuclear weapons production plants. Boy, I think I read that article and it scared the bejesus out of me. Keith, thank you so, so much for joining us today. And then I want to also, just before we start, you know, what led me to you was your September 13th article for The New Lead, where you posed the question, could farm fertilizers be driving Corn Belt cancers? And it turns out that this is one of many stories that you have been filing on the state of our waterways and the pollution that is generated by our agricultural model. So tell us a little bit about that project and what prompted you to get onto this story in particular.
First, Katie, thanks for having me aboard. You know, this is really important to get this story out to more and more people so that they understand the dimensions of our water pollution contamination problem, the source of which is American agriculture. American agriculture is the largest polluter of water and one of the largest polluters of air of any industry that's ever existed in the United States, period.
That's right.
In terms of water, not coal, not mining, not chemicals, not refining, not metal production. No industry in this country's history has polluted the water the way that American agriculture is now. Now, I say that within the context of understanding that this industry is also technically proficient, highly engineered, really good on genetics. I mean, it produces an enormous amount of calories, right? So it produces basically, you know, a third or a quarter more calories than the entire world needs. So in terms of its productive capacity, it's really an amazing industry. It's one of the reasons that America is, you know, modestly stable right now, because we don't have to worry about our food supply. We can worry about the costs, but we don't have to worry about this food supply. But what's happening now is that Congress and the Biden administration passed laws, the infrastructure law, the Inflation Reduction Act, the climate provisions, which is putting energy at the forefront of agriculture production. So agriculture is going to be looked at as a major source of energy production. And the consequences of that for water are just frightening to me, because the water is already contaminated to the max. Iowa has the worst water quality in the country. It has some of the worst water quality in the world.
Right.
So this, I've been working on this now for almost 2 years. Last year, Circle of Blue published a series of articles on phosphorus pollution, which is the causes of harmful algal blooms, toxic algae that have contaminated the Chesapeake, contaminated Lake Winnipesaukee, contaminated Lake Erie, contaminated iconic waterways, is killing porpoises on the West Coast. And in doing that work, I just naturally was led to nitrates, nitrogen, which is a component of nutrients for agriculture in the Corn Belt. So that's 11 states in the middle of the country where most of our corn is produced. And corn is also the most heavily fertilized crop. And it's fertilized both by chemical fertilizers and manure from livestock agriculture. So over the last 30 years or so, we've developed this amazing industrial meat and dairy production system, most of it concentrated in the Corn Belt. So farmers, producers are applying fertilizer on top of the chemical, applying manure on top of the chemical fertilizer. Right. Manure is heavily saturated with nitrogen and phosphorus. And nitrogen, just naturally, 50 to 60 to 70% of it is not taken up by the crop. So it flows into the streams, it flows into the rivers, flows into groundwater. So all across the Corn Belt, we're talking from Minnesota down to Nebraska, Missouri, Iowa, Wisconsin, parts of Kansas, you know, are heavily contaminated groundwater and surface water with nitrogen, nitrates. And that's how I got to the health piece of this.
Right. So what you wrote about was a series of four families, and they all lived on one road in Minnesota, right? And and they somehow, every single one of those families had multiple cases of cancer within a fairly short time span. So I wanted you to just talk about that. But before we do that, let's review one thing. Let's start with, what is the EPA regulation of acceptable levels of nitrates in drinking water? And when was that limit set?
So in 1962, the Public Health Service of the United States established 10 parts per million, 10 milliliters per liter, health standard for nitrates in water. And they did so because the evidence was accumulating that nitrates in water, water that was, babies drinking contaminated water at that level had blue baby syndrome, which is it interfered with the hemoglobin uptake of their blood, and they got blue babies. And Public Health Service set that limit. And then in 1991, that limit was codified in federal law in the Safe Drinking Water Act, which is the federal law that protects groundwater for drinking.
Right.
And they codified that 10 milliliters per liter level safety standard into our drinking water law. But the evidence is clearer, and this is evidence not only in the United States but around the world, that that's an unsafe level for long-term exposure to nitrates in water. And so an increasing number of epidemiology studies, many of them done in the Corn Belt, many of them done by the University of Iowa and the Centers for Disease Control and the National Institutes of Health and health services around the world, including the World Health Organization, have begun to look at the populations of women and men exposed to nitrate levels at various levels, and have found that there's an elevated risk of cancers, colorectal cancers, breast cancers, soft tissue cancers. And anybody who wants to know this, all you have to do is go to Google and type in nitrates and cancer.
Yep.
And you will find hundreds of studies that have appeared, many of them recently, around this problem, around this risk. Now, Circle of Blue has been, this is a small news organization here in northern Michigan where I live, has been tracking this, has been really interested in this, and has probably done the best work in the country on this. So 2 years ago, one of our correspondents, Brett Walton, who's in Seattle, tracked down a cancer cluster of kids, pediatric cancers in Nebraska, and wrote a two-part series about the links between pediatric cancers and high nitrate levels in drinking water in Aurora, Nebraska, and neighboring towns. And in doing the current project on nitrates, I was in southern Minnesota talking to a wonderful, wonderful lawyer who's also a farmer. Her name is Sonia Trome Ayers. And I'm interviewing her, and we're talking about these issues. And she says, you ought to take a look up there in Dodge County, which is a neighboring county to her farm, where, her mother-in-law lived there, who died of cancer.
Yeah.
And there's a road up there. They call it Cancer Road. And of course, my ears perked up. I'm like, what? Cancer Road? What are you talking about? Well, go see some of these folks. I went up there and I interviewed, I found a couple of these people and I interviewed them about what had happened on Dodge County's County Road B, which is in northwestern part of Dodge County. Now, what's interesting, you can only do these pieces if you're a journalist. If you have people that, you know, suspect a cancer, but with a particular source, nitrates, but you got to track that back into their exposures. Well, Dodge County has been documenting nitrate levels in their drinking water for decades. And as part, they do so as a health safety measure, because if you're selling a house in Dodge County, you have to know what's in the water up there, because, you know, it's in the middle of both livestock agriculture and heavy corn production.
Right.
And the nitrate, they know the nitrates are in the water, and people who are buying homes need to know what's in their water. Right. So here in my county, we do that with our septic systems. You have to test your septics. You have to get them clean before you, at the point of sale of your house or building a new house. So they do that in Dodge County. So every family along this mile stretch of Dodge County, of County Road B, had a long history of nitrate well testing there. And there have been various and sundry civic, you know, responses to livestock development there, mostly hog farms. Who have been, you know, they've been very concerned about how many hog farms are up there. So they're very interested in what's happening in their water. And every one of those families, I documented four families in which there were, you know, over a dozen cancers, seven deaths. And the water testing that had been done by the county showed elevated levels of nitrates. I mean, we're talking 5 parts per million to up to 30 parts per million in the water there. And it corresponded, I mean, that what those well water tests and the cancers in those families corresponded. I mean, they were very consistent. And that was why I was able to write that story.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, I actually did quite a bit of digging around looking for more information on this. And I found that there were, you know, more recent studies, but there were, you pointed to a study that was conducted as long ago as, I think, 22 years. That linked elevated nitrate levels in drinking water with an increased risk for bladder and ovarian cancers. But I was just curious that was one of the more recent studies, and that in the past, in the very recent past, I think there was only one. The Environmental Working Group did a series of peer-reviewed studies around this issue, and that was in 2019. And aside from that, I really couldn't find anything else to read about this. And I was kind of struck by that, because it would seem to me that you would be finding these elevated incidents of cancer clusters along with the nitrates all through the Farm Belt. And yet somehow it's sort of presented as if these are kind of isolated instances instead of being what I would imagine would be a cancer highway through farm country, right? I mean, like, have we seen any epidemiological studies that link all of this together?
Well, the newest studies have been in Europe, where it's less politically hazardous.
We're going to talk about that. Yeah.
But the newest study was Mary Ward's study. I think it's 2018. The really important studies that started this came out of the University of Iowa. And Iowa is still leading the charge here. Iowa has a group called the Iowa Cancer Consortium. And it's a collaboration between scientists and local government and state government. And they are very interested in this, because Iowa has now the second highest cancer incidence in the country. And it's the only state in which cancer incidence is increasing. By the way, five of the 15 states with the highest cancer incidence, five are in the Corn Belt. So there are these very strong suggestive, let's just call that, links between high nitrate contamination. All those states have high nitrate contamination in their drinking water, in their groundwater, and cancer incidence. They also are, you know, they also have higher pesticide, you know, contamination in their, in their water.
They use a lot of herbicides, all of that stuff, right?
So,
of course.
And there appears to be some sort of a link between atrazine, which is a herbicide, and nitrates in water. That's what Nebraska is looking at. So you have in Nebraska, the University of Nebraska is very much, you know, trying to track this down. I interviewed the leader of that project. And in Iowa, I interviewed the leader of that project. Now, Andrew Austin Bate, who's a Democratic legislator in Iowa, announced after we, right after we published this story about nitrate and cancer in Minnesota, which that's where it started. That's the dateline. Announced that he's going to take up hearings early next year on cancer in Iowa and trying to track down the causes and the sources. And that Iowa Cancer Consortium, which is important university allies in that on that committee, are very interested in tracking down. Why wouldn't they? But now,
I can think of a lot of reasons. I mean, Chris Jones. I mean, he got bounced for talking about Iowa water quality. I don't see why these people are not going to suffer the same fate if they step too hard on the industry toes.
Well, this is coming out of the University of Iowa.
I mean, so was Chris.
I broke Chris's story. Chris has become a good friend of mine. I just saw Chris a couple nights ago out in Iowa for a meeting that I was out there. Yeah, I mean, what happened to Chris was just abominable. And neither the University of Iowa, he was a researcher on their payroll, not a tenured faculty.
That's
but
true.
Neither the Iowa State or the University of Iowa said a word. So, yes, so there is a risk for being a public about your concerns about these kinds of issues. Nevertheless, at the University of Northern Iowa, there's researchers there that are very involved in this. And of course, the Iowa Cancer Consortium, and Mary Charlton is the head of it. And she's really, she's University of Iowa. So they're pursuing this because they have a public health risk there that's massive, massive.
Right, absolutely.
Same in Nebraska, same in Missouri, same in Wisconsin, same in Minnesota. So these things, when you're taking on a systemic challenge like this in the current context of our era, these are generational changes. That making change on this is a generational campaign. And so we're starting. I mean, the United States is starting to look at this. And under Biden, and the EPA is starting to move on this. Just last week, Circle of Blue, Brett Walton, our correspondent in Seattle, broke a big story about how the EPA is going to now be taking up a formal assessment of the health risks of nitrates in drinking water.
Oh, wow.
EPA wanted to do that under Biden, but Trump administration, Trump EPA said, no, we're gonna put this aside. But the current administration, the Office of Water, just took this up and are going to take a look at a formal assessment. That, that's a 10-year project, right?
Yeah, yeah.
If they're going to rewrite the health standard for nitrates in drinking water, it's going to take 10 years. That's how it goes. And it's going to be a political nightmare, because the Farm Bureau and the Pork Council and the dairy producers and the fertilizer groups, and they're gonna challenge it, and those groups have won some of the big cases in court about this.
Sure, absolutely. We're gonna take a short break, Keith, and we'll be right back. We got to take a sponsor drop right now, but stay tuned, people. We got lots more coming.
Hi, listeners. We wanted to let you know that Heritage Radio Network's Julia Child Fellowship application is now open. The fellowship offers an enriching experience for aspiring food writers and journalists who share our passion for food systems change. The fellowship is a great way to progress in the field of food journalism and digital media, and will start in early January 2024. This fellowship will provide participants with hands-on experience, mentorship, and access to an extensive network of industry professionals. The application deadline is November 27, 2023. Check out heritageradionetwork.org and click on the Julia Child Foundation Writing Fellowship link to learn more. If you or someone you know has interest in food studies and journalism, this might be a great fit. Go to heritageradionetwork.org and check out the application today. Thank you.
Okay, so that is very encouraging news about the EPA, because as you no doubt saw in the end of my outline, I was like, do we need to get rid of the EPA? Because, I mean, honestly, this is just the tip of the iceberg of things that have not been effectively evaluated in terms of their impact on public health. Farm chemicals are only just part of that story. I mean, cosmetics, personal care products. I mean, the list goes on and on. It's pretty scary. But one thing I wanted to go back to with you about was when you were talking about the idea of this is a risk. They have identified that nitrates in the water are a risk for public health issues, especially for cancers of all various types that you ran through. But then when does that become, quote, and this is your story, I'm quoting, evidence for a relationship between drinking water nitrate ingestion and adverse health outcomes? So who is going to make that determination that we've gone from a risk to a relationship? You know what I mean? These are parsing this stuff out is.
Well, now whether exposure to nitrates in drinking water is a cancer risk, right? They're studying large populations, right?
Right.
Large populations. Where we know that cancer is, these kinds of cancers and these kinds of constituents, compounds can cause cancer, generally starts with a smaller population affected. For instance, benzene, right? Benzene is a known cancer risk because sailors in the Navy exposed to high levels of benzene on ships, they could identify smaller populations and the high exposures. Same thing with radiation, right? Radiation is a known cancer risk, and it became very clear that it's known cancer risk, starting with, you know, Madame Curie. But, you know, miners, uranium miners in the Southwest that were mining uranium for the Manhattan Project, those miners began dying of lung cancers from exposure to the radon from uranium mining, right? That's the radon risk. And you know, tobacco and lung cancer. Well, you had, you know, prevalence of lung cancers in groups, you know, that were exposed to high smoking risk. So to do this, you know, I have to separate all the way the epidemiologists say this is you got to separate all the other potential risks and identify a single risk, right? So in drinking water, especially in the Corn Belt, I mean, there's a lot of stuff in it, right? There's,
yes,
as you know. So how do you separate? Is there a synergistic relationship between nitrates and atrazine? That's what they're looking at in Nebraska. Is there a synergistic relationship between nitrates and, I don't know, 2,4-D or you know, whatever pesticides they're using out there?
Or even phosphorus, you know, like as an additive to fertilizer. I mean, that's what I mean about the sort of the failures of the EPA in the sense of like not making you know, not putting components together and recognizing that this can form a third component, which then could generate cancer, you know, when it wouldn't be either one on its own. I just feel like there's a lot of serious tunnel vision in the way chemicals are approached by the EPA.
And vulnerable to political pressure always.
Yeah.
So the EPA operates in a political maelstrom. And it shifts its attention from one administration to the next. We know that. I mean,
yeah.
So they took up the nitrate study now to look at whether nitrates whether the current 10 part per million nitrate level is safe. I mean, they're going to do it. They're going to evaluate it. Well, and they're going to take 10 years to get it done if they write a new rule. But they're doing it where, you know, they tried to do it under Obama and Trump administration killed it. So they're taking it back up. You asked whether the EPA, do we need the EPA? Yes, we need the EPA. I mean, anybody who's been to India or China, my friends come back from India and China, I'll never complain about the EPA again. You know, the EPA has done, you know, so the EPA has done amazing work to me. I mean, it's a very difficult work that they do. They're subject to all these political machinations. Their budgets are up, their budgets are down. I mean, to be an EPA scientist, you got to be a hero, in my view. I mean, yes, they're a flawed agency. What's not a flawed agency? I mean, and to regulate in the current context, whether it's a Democratic administration or Republican administration, is tough. It's very tough. But I say the EPA is getting stuff done. I mean, they're getting stuff done. I mean, look at the work that they're doing out in the Klamath Basin with the Corps to take out those big dams that have been hindering salmon runs and distressing the Native American tribes out there for decades. They're finally getting it done. It took a generation to do that. And as I say, these things take generations to get done, these big systemic changes in America today. I mean, that's how long it takes. So we would be a much worse off nation had we not had the EPA enforce the Clean Water Act in its point sources. I mean, and the fact is that they have been very reluctant. They've been very reluctant by law to deal with, you know, any other contamination from non-point sources. And that's the big flaw. And the EPA said in 2016, non-point pollution from agriculture is the worst, you know, it's the major cause of pollution in the United States. And they can't get to it. And until we change the law or we, you know, consider so-called qualified non-point sources to be point sources. And let's talk about that. I was just at the Biodigester Conference in Iowa, at Iowa State, in Ames, Iowa, which, by the way, Iowa State is, you know, the Jerusalem of where we started to talk about large livestock agriculture, man. I mean, they're right. they're the source of it. And they had this big conference on it. And it was, you know, Katie, it was like what it must have been like in the early 60s when the utility industry got together with the Atomic Energy Commission to start talking about, you know, civilian nuclear power. You know, where it's going to be too cheap to meter and it's going to be non-polluting. It's going to be the perfect thing. This Biodigester conference was like that, in which they're, you know, talking about clean energy and, you know, cleaning the air of methane and, you know, energy from manure and how much, you know, what the power potential is and how people are going to really enjoy it. And I'm thinking, Jesus, you know, this could make water pollution so much worse. I didn't stand up and make it to do. I didn't respond to it. I just was listening to it. But the joy and optimism in that room was just frightening.
Well, it is. I mean, they are treating it like it's the Holy Grail. I mean, even to the point where I believe some of the big companies, Cargill, maybe in Tyson, are starting to install biodigesters in some of their larger CAFOs. Sort of as a, you know, I mean, I see it as a sop to all of the people who are complaining about the problems from odor and water pollution. But, you know, they do. I mean, I went to a Cargill plant. I was given the tour of a Cargill plant out in Colorado about 7 or 8 years ago. And they had one of the first biodigesters and they were unbelievably proud about it. And they were pumping that water right back out into the Colorado River. I mean, you know, they were. And
were they treating it?
Yeah, they claimed that it was, you know, being cleaned, and they were, you know, they were using the methane in their power as power for their plant, and they were taking the solids, and those were now, you know, sterilized, and so they could spread those as fertilizer. Blah 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 blah. I mean, you know, it was the Holy Grail.
So that's the upside of it, right? So if so the biodigestion could help to limit the pollution from livestock agriculture, right?
Good.
But the way the agriculture sector is viewing this and the way the EPA is viewing this and the way the states are viewing this is they're not going to regulate the digestate.
Oh,
so you can put the same digester put on an agriculture operation is unregulated in how they treat, manage the digestate. Unregulated, just like livestock.
Just
manure.
Like the manure, right.
And but the same equipment on a food processing plant or a municipal wastewater treatment plant is regulated, heavily regulated.
Right.
So in Michigan, the other thing that you need to know, Katie, is that the oil industry and Big Ag are now joining on this, on biodigestion.
Really?
So we have Chevron, you know, owns a company called Brightmark, which has built 5 biodigesters on our big dairy CAFOs here.
Oh, really?
I mean, and they won't talk to me. So, I mean, this biodigester thing is potentially enormous story. I'm going to write the hell out of it. But, it's, you know, so that, you know, in Michigan, if you put a biodigester on a wastewater treatment plant, for instance, you have to, the liquid waste that comes out of the biodigester goes back into the system to be treated. The solids can have, if they're land treated, have to go under really strict biosolid land disposal practices. They're really strict about where they can put them and what can be in them. And but if you put manure into a biodigester and you have an agriculture operation, you don't have to do anything with the liquids. You can spread them anywhere you want. And the solids, you can do anything you want with them. You can, you know, so the potential for digesters to make this water pollution problem worse is immense, really immense. And it's all funded, publicly funded, because the incentives to do all this stuff, there's billions of dollars in this,
right,
you know, maze. I mean, a goddamn maze of this tax incentive gives you this bonus if you do, you know, put this food stuff in it or this into it. I mean, there's so much opportunity for the renewable fuel standards, the low carbon fuel standards. I mean, I listen to all the financing thing. You can't, I mean, it's gobbledygook to me, but there's 20 different ways to finance these with publicly financed.
Wow.
And the thing is, it's expensive to do, right? So it costs millions to hook up. If you want to use your methane for energy, for gas, natural gas, to hook up to a natural gas pipeline, A, the cook-up fees are like millions. The compressing and processing stuff is millions more. So these things aren't going to go on small CAFOs.
The people at Cargill told me it cost $20 million. They were very proud. They had spent $20 million creating their biodigester thing. And it was, you know, honestly, it wasn't huge. And this was in a processing plant. This was not at a CAFO. So this was all of the residue from processing animals, i.e. all the blood, you know, the fats, the blah, you know, all of the whatever they don't end up putting in a rendering plant and turning into, you know, all of the products that we turn stuff into. But I mean, it was, you know, they were audibly patting themselves on the back, you know.
Look at it. I mean, what this is going to do potentially is to make CAFOs even larger.
Sure.
So there was a group there, Rosaline Energy, that has like 12 CAFOs hooked up to these biodigesters. They spent $180 million. These are Smithfield hog operations.
Right.
You know, and so they're talking about they're going to be able to try this on smaller CAFOs. No, this is going to drive larger CAFOs because CAFOs are going to become manure producers. The milk and dairy is going to be secondary to producing the energy. That's what's going to happen here.
Whoa, you heard it here first, folks. I think you're absolutely right, Keith. That makes sense.
So it's such a great story because you can talk about the promise of it, right? If it's regulated, and you can talk about the risks if it's not.
Right. And of course, let's point out just one more time for listeners that agriculture is largely and almost completely unregulated, right? You are not regulated as far as how your air pollution. I know that from doing the research on CAFOs. And you're not really regulated in terms of how much fertilizer you can use and pesticides and herbicides and so on. You might get in trouble if your point source, you know, if you are identified as somebody who's polluting local groundwater, but otherwise nobody's saying nothing to you about how you run your business.
There's no limits on how much chemical fertilizer you can put on your land. And there's basically no limits on how much manure you can put on the land. Although they'll tell you, well, we have nutrient management plans.
Yes, right.
And I said, well, great. You have which you're supposed to, you know, dictate, you know, where you can spread and how much you can spread and what times you can spread. And I say to them, well, great, you have all these things, but, you know, nitrate contamination all across the Corn Belt is getting worse, both in surface and groundwater. What's the answer to that in Iowa? Well, the MAGA legislature wants to take out the monitoring systems in the streams. Yes. That's the Chris Jones story.
Right.
Chris Jones was hired 6 or 7 years ago. He's a PhD chemist. He was hired out of the Soybean Association in Iowa.
Yeah.
He's no radical environmentalist. And, you know, they hired him to establish and build this monitoring system for nitrates and streams. And he did 66 stations statewide. It's, you know, 24/7. You can watch, see the results of what's happening in streams on your computer. And so they bounce him out of University of Iowa. And now they want to kill the stream monitoring system.
Right. Very, very close. In fact, I think he published something today about that. If I'm not mistaken, I didn't get a chance to read it through. But anyway, I want to just go on for a minute further about, talk about a little bit about what it takes to get nitrates out of water. Like, it's quite an expensive and difficult process. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that and why, it's been so slow to get off the ground in terms of communities that are seriously affected by nitrate pollution. And yet they don't really have a mechanism that is effectively removing nitrates from water that's cost effective.
That's the issue. I mean, Des Moines has a really sophisticated nitrate filtration system. They've installed it. They tried to challenge the three upstate counties that were farming counties that were pouring nitrates from their fields into the Raccoon River. They lost that case in 2015.
Right.
U.S. District Judge threw it out under heavy political pressure.
Yes.
And they have a extensive nitrate filtration system. It costs millions of dollars to run it. It costs millions more to build it.
Right.
They have to, you know, they have to change the filter. I mean, you can do it, but if you have a small township in southern Minnesota and there are a bunch of them that have contaminated water in their groundwater and their drinking water, multi-million dollar systems are really, really tough to build. So the other thing that they consider is deeper wells, right? Go to a different aquifer deeper. That costs millions of dollars too, to drill those wells and operate those pumps.
Sure.
So, you know, so what do you do about this? Well, there's federal money now to under the infrastructure law to help some of that. You know, there's drinking water sources of grants and funding to do that.
Yes.
And little towns are tapping it. But what's the real source? The real source is, this is not hard to solve if your groundwater hasn't been contaminated, right? You just reduce the amount of nitrate and phosphorus you're putting on the ground, which right. You can do. I mean, agriculture can use much less fertilizer than they're putting on the ground. And I wrote a piece about that as part of this, about this project, which is, Iowa State has many, many, many studies that says, you know, you can use half as much chemical fertilizer in ground and get just the same kinds of yields. Uh-huh. And there's a limit. You know, if you put 150, 200 pounds of nitrogen per acre on your ground, you know, you're going to get 200 bushel per acre corn yields, right? But if you put 300 pounds of nitrogen on the ground, it's not going to change your corn yield. And there are these famous graphs that just show a straight line. There's an endpoint on how much nitrogen the crop needs. You put more on, it doesn't going to do anything to yields. But why do farmers use more? It's insurance. They put more on because just in case a rain comes and washes some away, or they just use it as economic insurance plan. So
right.
If we reduce how much we're putting on the ground, it's not rocket science. You reduce more, then you get less runoff. So that's one solution. Two is you can drill deeper wells. Three, you can install nitrate filtration systems. And there are some other, you know, reverse osmosis type systems that you can put on your drinking water. But we ought to have a system in which we're asking farms. I mean, these are not the little 80 cow per farm operations or
right.
300 acre operations. These are massive, sophisticated. They got $600,000 tractors and $1 million combines that, you know, their equipment sheds have millions of dollars of high tech equipment.
Absolutely.
These operations are highly sophisticated. And, you know, why don't states or the federal government require some monitoring wells to see what's going on with their nitrates? That's easy. I mean, if you have nitrates in your groundwater, you're done because, once you get toxics in your groundwater, it's damn near impossible to get it out of there.
That's true.
Once you've contaminated it, it's gone. So
yeah, yeah.
The solution to this is not to contaminate it. That's the solution.
Well, and also, I mean, the other thing is you think, well, you know, I think it was the Environmental Working Group study that showed the cost to the taxpayer, essentially, for what it costs for these cancer clusters or for these large populations who are then coming down sick, lost productivity. You know, the financial burden is in the billions of dollars to not address these problems. And that's the part where I'm just like, I don't get it, man. You know, I don't get it. Like you said, it's very simple. Reduction, reduce your amount. Well, same thing. I mean, it's like, you know, if you know that this is a problem, here's another way that you can, you know, save money, because that's what everybody's all worried about, right? I don't know, Keith.
Right.
I don't know.
The other part of this is there's tremendous tolerance to contaminated water here in the Great Lakes region. You know, Lake Erie is a problem, but there isn't like this great big civic resistance, you know, protest movement. So similarly in the Corn Belt, I mean,
true.
It's accepted, you know, it's accepted because agriculture is such a big part of the economy. And so, you know, like anything else, you know, coal towns were very concerned about closing their coal-fired power plants or their mines, steel manufacturing towns also, when environmental regulators came in to stymie the pollution coming out of the air and the water from steel plants. It's similar in the Corn Belt. So
sure.
you can be sympathetic to the view that, you know, we ought to be careful about what we're doing to our major industry. But the other side of this is that people are being exposed to, you know, these potentially dangerous contaminants in their water. So these are not easy, but the extent of the contamination is just astonishing to me. I'd had no idea when I started this what we were up,
right.
You know, really what I was going to encounter. But You know, so much of Minnesota's groundwater is contaminated with very high nitrate levels, similarly in Iowa, similarly in Nebraska, Wisconsin. That's why, you know, there are these pockets of resistance in these states. And, you know, the legislatures, for the most part, are indifferent to the civic restiveness. Not the case in Iowa now. Iowa is starting to move on cancer and the causes of cancer in Iowa and the groundwater, the relationship of groundwater contamination to those cancers.
Right. Amazing. Well, we're going to have to wrap it up there. This has been great, Keith. I really appreciate your time. It's a lot of fun to talk to you. And this has been a very interesting discussion. We will continue it. Tell people how they can learn more about you and your work and the Toxic Terrain Project. And
It's easy to get to Toxic Terrain. Just, you know, on Google, Toxic Terrain, Keith Schneider, and it'll all pop up. They can learn more about me. I have a blog, Mode Shift. It's called modeshift.org. But, you know, I'm the last of the frontline correspondents out there. You know, I have a fairly extensive profile on Google. You know, type my name into it. Plenty of stuff will come up. So that's, you know.
I'll be checking it out for sure. And I'll definitely read all those other Toxic Terrain. Yeah.
Thanks so much, Katie. Appreciate
Thank you. It was great. Yeah. Great fun. Really enjoyed it. And we'll talk to you again very soon, I'm sure.
Okay.
So long for now.
What Doesn't Kill You? Food Industry Insights is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network. Food radio supported by you. Keep in touch at heritageradionetwork.org/subscribe.
I want to tell you about a new podcast called Amuse News. Publishing multiple days a week, Amuse News is your source for food news, interviews from around the food world, and more. On the show, we'll be engaging with food storytellers, from chefs to advocates to people working in the field, and many more. Find Amuse News wherever you get your podcasts. Amuse News is a destination for everyone who's looking for a new, insightful look into the world of food.